access number 28674, Mr. Richard Corsbrook, Reel 7. Now, we're talking about when you've gone forward to Tehran, we've talked about the aid that was going through to the Soviet Union, you know. That's a backdrop to what's going on. Now, what's the next thing you recall? What's the next story?
Well, wait a minute. Let me. Okay, the raison d'etre for being in Tehran, of course, there was an army headquarters there. There were troops to protect the LFC, line of communication. Certainly not particularly obvious. It's a slightly different kettle of fish from comparing it with what's there now. You wouldn't dare leave one of these line posts halfway up a mountain in Persia or Baghdad or Tehran or Iraq or anywhere else, because the locals would knock hell out of it. It was a very, very benign situation. But we had a headquarters, a British headquarters, as much, I suspect, now for intelligent purposes as anything else, because it's something I have never quite caught up with, what the intelligence implications were up that way, up there. But I've subsequently realised that there was more intelligence going on than probably anything else. You had the Russians, had the Americans running the aid up. That had to be protected. We had a Gurkha regiment up there, so presumably that was as part of it. What the British headquarters did, apart from making sure that there were enough troops to protect the place and a bit of intelligence, I don't know. But there we all were, sitting in a converted hospital in the west end of Tehran. And eventually the Americans appeared, and this everything eventually means in a matter of probably weeks, because by the time the Americans established a very large headquarters in Tehran, and of course we got very, because we were, so to speak, sharing facilities. I mean, they provided us connections on their line to the south. We provided them with a service on our line to the south, far Baghdad. We had a fair amount of contact with the Americans. Not only did we swap material, but they gave us access to their canteen. What's it called?
It's gone out of my head, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. They're equivalent to our NAFI, so that we could get plenty of their beer. And we made sure they had plenty of our whiskey. And at the end of the war, they made me a companion of honour or something, whatever the American equivalent is to the MBE. That was for whiskey, and that was for the... But no, we had a lot to do with the Yanks.
How did you get on with them individually? You know?
Very well. I mean... there were one or two, Major Gear, Colonel, I can't remember, absolutely good blokes. Surprisingly mild, you know, we'd been taught what the Americans were like from films, but these were very, very easy to get on with people, because we would socialise with them, and they would socialise with us, and not only did we pass beer and whiskey and cigarettes between ourselves, they came down to our mess, we went up to theirs. It was always a good dodge. I mean, if you were, you know, go up to the Yanks about 11 o'clock in the morning, and you'd end up with having a damn good lunch. American style, don't forget. I never quite got reconciled to the way they ate jam with their savoury food, but... Well, they were very pleasant there. But we had a community of, you know, not a community of interest. We had a joint responsibility for keeping the lines going. And we were, in the end, became quite suspicious of them, because being Americans, they weren't there just to look after the military commitment, that it's pretty obvious that they were digging their feet in so that at the end of the war they'd be three yards ahead of everybody else when it came to commercial business, commercial reasons. But the UK was never very good in those days at seeing what was going on in front of their noses. But they were.
And you didn't realise at the time there was a commercial imperative to what they were doing.
No. It wasn't obvious, but it became obvious as soon as the war was ending.
In what way?
They were putting down connections with the local people, local organisations, that would ensure that they got asked first, so to speak. Nothing that you could say was immoral in any sense. They were just making sure the opportunities were there. Whereas we would get out. Whole opportunities to get out quick, you know, when the time came. They were going to get out quick, but they were going to make damn sure that the Persians knew they were what they had and could do.
So what happens next then?
We've gone up there sometime between January 44 and I know we were well established in there by D-Day because of the. Yeah, I remember the news coming across the radio.
How did you react? What news did you hear?
The announcement that was it John Snagg who announced that this morning British troops, you know, had landed in, and I suspect then we got Churchill coming on afterwards, later on in the day. We heard the broadcast. You know, we did have a radio in the office. And I remember it was on there.
And how did everyone react? It's a long way away from Tehran.
Yeah. I said, well, that's good, isn't it? I mean, the attitude was, well, we can move another line on the map now. We can put another front in and cross your fingers. We're not being too optimistic at this stage, you know, not until about the France fell in or till Paris fell in August. It looks as if we might be able to go home soon, which was the sort of. I mean, it was certainly no vast celebration. There was some. I remember at some point in the war having a vast party when somewhere fell. I can't remember what it was. It was in the 42. 43 area, but it could have been when Rome fell, but there wasn't any great reaction. No great reaction, but to some extent relief, because you were sitting out there, you didn't know what was going to go on. The Russians were by then not doing too badly, but if you're talking about 43, as you go through 43, it definitely wasn't until about 44 that the Russians were really beginning to relieve the Caucasus. We had our lines on the map and think, oh good, well that's an improvement. I don't think people have asked me, you know, what were you doing? Did you know what was going on? I think we knew no more than anybody knew from the news bulletins. There was no surprise that the invasion of Europe had taken place. But in no way were we in any position to sort of say, well, it's this week, isn't it? And that was, I presumably, true overall. The Germans knew that something was going to go on, not that they knew quite where it was going to happen. And the whole build, you couldn't conceal the build-up. in this country of the Americans for the invasion. But what the details were and when it was all going to happen, we had no way of knowing.
So what happened after D-Day?
Well, with D-Day, nothing. There was no serious, no change, obviously, in the situation up there. We were still doing the same job. We had to keep the same communication service going. The Americans were still running aid to Russia.
Were there any serious breaks, or was it just a matter? I know that your job is to stop there being serious breaks, but were there any that occurred that you had to resolve, or was it a matter of that your constant maintenance and checks made?
Well, I've got two stories there. Two communication break stories. One is very technical. I'm sorry about that.
Tell it just as you would. Ignore me.
Yeah,
I probably won't understand it.
One is very technical. One is quite technical. Yes, we had a lot of trouble on the. Well, it was more the more Persians there were around. In other words, from the first line going south was from Tehran to Qazvin. And then from Qazvin, it went over the hills and wandered its way down eventually to get to Iraq. We had a lot of trouble with the locals. I've mentioned this before, pinching the copper. Good thing, you know, lovely copper, make pots and pans out of it. This was on the, as I say, on the line from Tehran to Qazvin. And was not very far out, not very far down the line from Tehran. And this was getting troublesome. It happened every night. The Americans were a bit fed up because we gave them a circuit on our system, and they kept losing their circuits. They said, "Well, we'll come and help you." We did two things, actually. We called in the Gurkhas, but at the same time, we called in the Yanks, who put onto the, obviously on a telephone line, you can pull out the connectors and you can put what you like out to the line, leaving what's that way isolated. And if you do the same further down, you've got a piece of line just hanging up in the, are hanging up on poles, which isn't connected to anything. But the Yanks came along with a 2kV, 2,000 volt generator, which we stuck on it. And we also had the Gurkhas. But the combination of the two meant that if they got hold of the line, they fell off. And the Gurkhas would catch them and cut them up to bits. And so we kept our line going between Tehran and Qazvin. And that was the only serious occasion, serious point. This war officially would have been in 45. The other interesting thing was that I got a report that we'd lost the circuit from Tehran to Baghdad. And there were Morse signals coming across. I said, "What? Well, we don't send Morse on these lines. These are purely carrier telephony and carrier telegraphy." Anyway, there was one area, I can remember the location, so I must have gone out at that time to have a look. It was way down in South Persia, and it had happened. We had a long line going between two hills. It was quite a long span, and it had broken. Nobody had no sabotage. It just broken. The line then was unbalanced. I'm sorry, I'm using technical terms, but if a line is balanced, it doesn't pick anything up from outside. But as soon as one half falls down, the line is unbalanced. So I knew the frequency, okay, I knew what frequencies the carrier system worked on, somewhere around 50 kcs. I looked up the master frequency of everything in the world, and there, stuck on the 50, whatever this frequency was, 52.3 kcs, I mean, was the German submarine extra long wave transmitter at Brest. So we were picking up the submarine signals for the submarines on our open wire. I don't think we ever made any attempt to decode them, it was a good idea to explain it to the people who said, we've got Morse coming through on this line. But, you know, the reliability of those circuits was, I think, phenomenally high. But what I'd like to do, I don't know whether it's preserved anywhere, but I imagine, certainly when I was the only officer in the signals headquarters, we used to keep the war diary, and I'm sure they must be filed somewhere in the National Archive. Every day I would sit down and write what happened today, like nothing, I got the impression that we had quite good service out of our lines. Anyway, we've got ourselves to Tehran. Let's talk about Tehran. Unconventional. We must have been a very unconventional lot of army officers. No great spit and polish. Relatively informal. And we stayed in a established mess for a time. When dear old Potty Watson said, I think we want our own mess, don't we, boys? Yes, we do, sir. Remember, there was a colonel, a major, two or three captains, and a couple of lieutenants. That was the mess. That was to be the signal staff mess. And we got ourselves, by means I don't know, a very nice house in the not too far from the office. I mean, it was about a half a mile or a mile from the office, in a side street in Tehran. I had a room right on the top floor with a balcony and looking out. And of the other staff had equally comfortable rooms. Picture but somehow or other I'd acquired a proper bed. I'd acquired it down in Basra and got it from the previous major who'd, I haven't got myself promoted yet, have I? No. Okay. I'm still a captain G2. I think I must have got it off somebody who moved on. Anyway, this was this fine, a good single bed, and it was carted everywhere from then on. We've gone up to about established the mess and. At that point, again, lots of other stories interlace, not bits of history interlace, because remember, we're now at the beginning of 44, and the Russians are trying to get rid of the Poles that they've extracted.
Is this 44 or 45?
44. We're still coming up to VE. To D-Day, 44. We've moved up to Tehran early in 44. So we're covering 44. The colonel says, "Let's have our own mess." So we have our own mess. Very nice house. And the Poles were, the Russians were bringing the Poles across into North Persia, into Tehran or into Persia. And they were encamped. They were encamping, putting them in camps in Tehran and trying to get rid of them. Literally trying to push them somewhere. And we managed to get a Polish staff to run the mess. Polish, couple of elderly middle-aged Polish woman, and with I think one or two daughters. And there's another story, because we had awful trouble, because one of the officers in the signal regiment, not our staff, that was, you know, which ran the signal, did that, did all the work on the signals, he wanted to marry, and I think he did, one of the Polish girl, Polish cook's daughters. And I believe there was terrible trouble. They didn't want one of their officers to marry this girl. That's an aside. But they were running the mess right through 44, because we bought some ducks. We had a pond in the mess garden, if that's what you call it. And we had some ducks. We ate them for Christmas. I don't know who killed them, but we didn't. And we were marvellously cared for. And it was one of the Polish cooks who made us a most potent drink at Christmas, which I understand is a well-established drink in that part of the world, Krupnik Polski. I think we've got a bottle of it next door. But
now, this has jumped to the end of 44, then.
We're now running through. I mean, there's no progression. We're living a life. We're living a life in Tehran, from day to day, year to year.
So there's no particular chronology, because it's
there's no
duty.
Particular history. We have D-Day starts. Well, so what? All that means is, well, we've now got a better chance of going home next year or the year after than we had before. But we are stuck out there, and so long as Russia's in the war and trying to fight, we've got to protect the line of communication. Now, during 44, I'd gone down to Basra to be Captain Lines Officer, G2 Lines. I'd stayed that job right through to Basra, gone up to Tehran in early 44, and then got made the Major, G2 Signals, because the previous major had gone. I mean, the people got posted in and out all the time, for one reason or another. And anyway,
now, what did that mean? What was the role of the major?
Well, that was, as I described the G2, as being the immediate officer below the colonel. Responsible for the administration of the whole of the office and the whole service we were giving, in so far as he was serving the colonel.
So you're no longer just in charge of the lines, which would you
have. No, I've now become in charge of the whole damn lot. Didn't stop me rushing up and down the driving around, but it was simply a question of, if a brigadier visited and wanted to go around the lines, we would take him. So I was in 44 sometime. I can't date it.
It doesn't matter.
We're broad brush. And so, yes, and we're all happy. We're living this jolly little happy life in this mess in Tehran. And some of us, sometimes we really didn't want it to end. As I say, it was an uneventful life. What are we sitting here talking for hours about it? Because, you know, you go into the office in the morning and go home at night, and it was almost a civilian existence. If you wanted a decent meal, you'd get one. If you felt you wanted a change of diet, you'd go and get on the ring the Yanks up and say, hey, can I come and see you? I think we want to talk about something. And you'd go up and see the Yanks and have lunch, and always admired their coffee. Came back, they'd come and see us. But obviously, we kept the lines, we kept the communications going, which is what we were supposed to be doing.
So what's the next thing you're
doing? Well, the next thing then, you see, we've got, right through 44, there's not much change. The job is going on, the war is going off somewhere else. The Russians still want aid. Then you get into 45. I'll say we've had the ducks for Christmas. We've eaten the ducks for Christmas 44. Then it becomes obvious that things are going to change. The war's going to end. So next thing we remember is, well, the next big mark is, of course, D-Day.
No,
VE Day. And then you get, again, the radio in the office, John Snag, the end of the war. But we had already anticipated it, because we'd already made an agreement with the Persians, and the Americans had done the same, that they would get out within 6 months. So we're under a sort of 6 month notice to quit once we get to May. Well, when was it? VE Day? May.
May 45.
May, wasn't it? And so we begin to work up to that. Don't forget, things then immediately begin. Once we've got the peace, no difference until VE Day, really. Then things begin to slow down. We have our plans, and which is to get out of Persia, and to get out and stay out, obviously. By this time, we've got ourselves a new CSO, Colonel Rogers, LRC Rogers, a man of some sympathy to me, because he was a railway historian. And I remember he and I one day in Tehran going down to the goods yard to look at the trains, and finding, abandoned by the Americans, a collection of LMS, and I mean LMS, 280s, which we had brought up, which had British forces had taken out to Persia a couple of years before, 40, 41, 42, before, early in 42, and the Americans had said sod that, roughly, and put in all their diesels. And these poor neglected 280s, class 8s, were sitting there, and we sort of sadly wrung our hands and said, oh dear. And I'm still trying to find, a locomotive that was in Persia. I think there is one in the country somewhere that has been repatriated and being restored. But that was Colonel Rogers. That's just personalities filling in the personalities. Once the VE Day had happened, so the people couldn't get it. There were some, you know, some people couldn't get away fast enough. A certain Colonel Rogers had wanted to get away. The headquarters closed. We closed the chief signals officer's office in Tehran, and I then went to do the same job in the headquarters at Baghdad. We had had two headquarters, one in Baghdad, two signal CSOs, one in Baghdad, one in Tehran. I think we were supernumerary to the Baghdad one. I went down to
I went down to Baghdad as G2 on that headquarters, and